school safety.
I call the April 8th, 2026 meeting of the House Public Safety Committee to order. A quorum is present. Before we begin our meeting, I want to remind everyone that the committee chair maintains control of this hearing. I have the following expectations. Signs and placards are not permitted in the hearing room. Verbal outbursts, shouting, or disruptive behavior will not be tolerated. Applause or other audible demonstrations are not allowed. For safety reasons, standing or sitting in the walkways and aisles or obstructing or standing at your seat are prohibited. If you require any accommodations, please speak with our sergeant staff identified by the gold ties. Troopers and house security personnel are here and present to ensure everyone's safety. If you receive an entrance ticket, please retain it as it may be required for re-entry if you leave the hearing room. Failure to comply with the guidelines may result in removal from the hearing room. Thank you to the sergeant and armed staff who are present to help maintaining order. Representative Steer, have you had a chance to review the meetings of the April 7th, 2026 meeting?
I have, Mr. Chair, and I move to approve.
Representative Steer moves to approve the April 7th, 2026 meeting. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. Motion carries, and the minutes of the April 7th, 2026 meeting are approved. We have a busy agenda today, so I'm asking testifiers and members to keep your comments brief and on point, with the exception of 4282, which we heard a couple weeks ago. The bills we hear today have fiscal impacts, either the general fund or the special revenue account. We will be laying over all of the bills we hear today. The first bill on the agenda is House File 3753. Representative Bakeberg, please come to the testifier table with your testifiers. You're not a member of the committee, so I will move that House File 3753 come before the committee. Representative Bakeberg, please begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Novotny, Co-Chair Moeller, and members. My name is Ben Bakeberg. I have the honor to represent the communities of Prior Lake, Jordan, Shakopee, and the surrounding townships. Before I jump in and explain the bill, I'd like to thank Representative Schwartz and Chair Frazier for being co-chairs on this important bill. House File 3753, as my testifiers come up, we're good with that. House File 3753 establishes a school safety threat assessment pilot project with the simple goal of improving school safety for our students, for our teachers, and for staff across Minnesota schools. It directs the Department of Public Safety's Office of Justice Programs, in consultation with the School Safety Center, to implement a discrete and layered pilot program that identifies, prevents, and responds to potential threats, both visible and concealed, outside of the school building. And that's an important piece to keep in mind. So the components of the program, of this pilot program, the Department of Public Safety will oversee the project in consultation with the School Safety Center. The commissioner of the Department of Public Safety will identify and contract with a vendor that is able to meet the following criteria. First, that the system has an advanced threat anticipation system. There's real-time monitoring and alerts. There's a rapid response coordination option with emergency services. And this is a one part of a layered approach that will integrate with the current school safety plan that the district already has in place. The vendor may use predictive technology or AI tools, but the simple goal of this bill is to keep threats outside of our school buildings, thus keeping kids safe. The selection process for schools, there will be one school identified per congressional district, must have a mix of large and small school districts, and the districts that have existing infrastructure in place are ineligible. And the simple reason for that is we want to have broad representation for the report that we get, that right now in the bill is due on January 15th, 2027. Now, I will fully admit that's a quick turnaround, so we may need to have some conversations, so I'm glad the bill is being laid over. And there is a $4 million appropriation. So the simple goal of this bill is to enhance school safety in a proactive manner, leveraging technology, using data-driven tools to identify potential threats before they enter the school environment, and allows for early coordination and effective response. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd move to testimony.
Thank you. Please have your testifier state their name for the record and begin their testimony.
Dr. Timothy Childs.
Go ahead, Mr. Childs.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, vice co-chairs, and members of the committee. Thank you for having me today. My name is Dr. Timothy Childs, as I just said, and I want to thank Representative Bakeberg, Representative Frazier, and Representative Schwartz for sponsoring this important bipartisan legislation. Schools are a target for bad actors and people intending to do harm. I know this all too well. As a father, I received a phone call that no parent wants to receive. In 2014, my daughter was eating in the cafeteria with her friends. After she got up to leave, a gunman came in and shot her friends, who were sitting at the same table. That incident, that call, caused me to repurpose my life work. For more than 30 years, I had been working with the U.S. military and our allies on advanced weapon detection to keep our troops, aircrafts, our allies out of harm's way, as well as to keep our country safe. After receiving this call, I knew my team and I needed to repurpose this proven military technology to keep our students and children safe. Our system utilized millimeter wave technology, like the scanners at the airport, except this system is proactive. It proactively scans for weapons outside of the school building at the perimeter. This is combined with intelligence cameras to detect visible threats. By combining these two technologies, we can search for seen and unseen weapons, auto alert first responders, school officials when a weapon is detected. Also send text messages, phone calls, lock doors, divert buses, and set off alarms in seconds. We follow the school safety plan and protocol. Proactive notice is vital when every moment counts. Our system is discreet. It attaches to the outside of the building, so most people do not notice it, up in the eaves or up on the poles. So children, staff, and public feel that they are entering a welcome and safe environment. The system does not discriminate against anyone. Its purpose is to help everyone be safe. It meets all health and government safety regulations. Also, our system is safe as far as the data. We build it into the firewalls of the school district so data is protected and secure. The system does not obtain personal or student data. It is scanning only for threats. We look forward to your support on House File 3753 to keep our students safe. The intention of this legislation and our work is to ensure that no parent has to take the call that I had to take. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Childs. Next testifier, state your name and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, co-chair, vice chair, and members of the committee. My name is Carrie Johnson. I'm a clinical social worker and have been a social worker for over 30 years. I work in the community with our children as well as families of various ages and backgrounds. For the last 6 years, our children are dealing with various types of trauma. Children in structured learning environments are on high alert. They are constantly scanning their environment for safety and making sure they are safe in the community and at school. Safety is an ongoing situation in their life. When our children don't feel safe, they have difficulty learning. Gun violence has increased significantly over the past decades. What happened in the community often spills into learning environment, influencing safety concerns. House File 3753 provides an opportunity for our children to feel safe by putting up a discreet, proactive weapon detection system to search for and detect weapons and threats before they enter a school. We need our children to feel safe so they can learn and thrive. House File 3753 provides a solution. This legislation is an important step to provide our children with a safe place to learn. When children feel safe, They can thrive, they can learn, and their academic goals will increase. And collectively, this helps our state thrive. Thank you for your support on this important legislation.
Thank you. Next testifier, state your name and begin your testimony.
Chair Novotny and Moeller and members of the committee, my name is Reverend Alfred Babington Johnson. I'm the CEO of the Stairstep Initiative and convener of His Works United, the largest ecumenical collaboration of African-American churches in the state of Minnesota. The Stairstep Initiative is dedicated to confronting the breakdown of the spirit of community, which we believe is the most challenging issue of our times. The sub-issues that flow from this increasingly contentious environment in which we find ourselves include gun violence that has found its way into the homes of our political leaders, our schools, our workplaces, and too often, even into our places of worship. We have to strive to solve the underlying causes of violence, ranging from conditions of abject poverty that become a breeding ground for malevolent thoughts to recruitment to radical ideologies and the various scenarios that leave larger and larger numbers of lost souls fighting mental imbalance. The outcomes of death, injury, and grieving families and friends permanently scarred by violence are unacceptable. The demonstrable threat to our children in schools is not some far-fetched nightmare. It's a reality with names attached. There's a passage in the Bible where four lost souls had a conversation with themselves while sitting outside of a city walls in despair. They said to themselves, "Why sit we here till we die?" They challenged themselves to action in the face of bad outcomes. I implore you to accept the viable response in HF 3753 that provides advanced discrete weapon detection for both seen and unseen weapons. Let's provide the funding to the Department of Public Safety School Safety Center to create 8 pilots in schools across the state. Let me go on the record one final issue to address the concerns of those who don't want the intrusive collection of citizen data. This system doesn't connect data to be misused. It identifies specific threats and allows a timely response to save lives. We're all responsible for protecting our populace. This bill is an important step in that direction. Thank you.
Thank you. While they're up there, do the members have any questions for Representative Baker, Bakeberg, or his testifiers?
Mr. Chair, I assume there'll be questions on the bill allowed later to the bill author, et cetera.
Yeah, but do you have any for them right now?
Not for the testifiers, or not at this time.
Questions about the technology or anything like that?
Maybe I do have a couple of technology questions, but
Representative Pinto, go ahead.
Well, just maybe just asking. So the way this works is that like if somebody's outside of a school has like a concealed gun, the technology can identify. At that point, then police are alerted. Is that how that works? Maybe just a brief answer because I know we've got tight timing. But is that just in general how that works?
Yes. So it would be able to detect the threat, the gun, and then automatically notify those who are authorized in from the security plan, which could be the first responders, the police, the officials on campus, whoever. Yes.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you. So a concealed permit carry holder, for example, who's walking down on the sidewalk in front of a school, every one of those people who has a concealed weapon, the system would identify them and alert first responders. Is how that would work.
Okay. Yes, and we also have friend versus foe, so you can detect if they have a permit, and so they would know that
okay.
as well.
Yeah. So it's
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so it's interesting. So basically, you had somebody who's armed near a school, including again, lawfully possessing. This system would identify mm-hmm. them and would alert law enforcement to their presence in the school area. Okay, thank you. That's helpful. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was the chief author of the Student Data Privacy Act, which was a bipartisan bill looking at the data that is collected by third parties on students and ensuring that parents have control over understanding what data is collected, when it will be destroyed, and just having more transparency. So I'm just looking at the letter provided in our materials from the Notice Coalition, and they raised some questions that I definitely have in terms of how this would intersect with the Student Data Privacy Act and the goals that we had there. So what data is collected as part of this software, the system of surveillance? How long is it retained? Do parents have access to it?
Dr. Charles.
I have a lot of questions, but those are my questions.
To the chair, in response to the question, the data that's collected, the system created a database of threats and is scanning at a million scans per second looking for threats. It doesn't take any personal data, any student data, and it applies with all HIPAA laws and the laws of this country. So there is no personal data collected, but it's looking for threats. And then it follows the protocol when a threat is detected.
Representative Bakeberg.
Representative Feist, the way that I would connect it for us that aren't experts in the technology is very similar to a camera system that is already prevalent in schools across the state. There are data retention pieces that we have in place. We only access that the video if needed. And there's no individual student data that is collected in that area.
Representative Feist.
Yeah, so in another part of the section of that letter, they talked about the use of AI misidentifying items as weapons, such as clarinets, lunchboxes, a bag of chips. So if a child has a clarinet and the system identifies that inaccurately as a weapon, and then like first responders are called and there is an incident, like does that then go into the student's file? And is that then like a law enforcement record?
Representative Bakeford.
So I think we need to just step back and think about the broader goal of the bill is to identify weapons and threats that are coming in. If there is something that is identified as a threat, I, as a building principal, am going to be notified of that. So, and Dr. Childs talked about how this dovetails and is layered in collaboration with the already school safety plan that districts across the state have. So if there is a threat, I would frankly go outside as the building principal and I would greet that kid and I'd say, hey, is everything okay? And I would have a conversation outside of the school building and then we would determine if it was a real threat or not. If it wasn't a real threat, then the kid would go on with their day and the kid wouldn't have any idea that there was a detection. If there is a threat, then I need to make a determination as a building principal. Did the kid just forget that they had a knife in their pocket because they were on a camping trip over the weekend and they put the same jeans on that they had over the weekend? That happens all the time. Or is it a real threat? So the goal is to keep the threat and identify the threat outside of the building before the student gets into the building or before the threat gets into the building.
Representative Feist.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for those responses. I still have deep concerns just about adding surveillance that is driven by artificial intelligence. Representative Bakeberg, like you know your students, you know you are a school leader, and so I trust your personal judgment and understanding of the community of kids that you work with more than I trust technology. And I'm a bit of a Luddite and a bit of a paranoid person when it comes to like student surveillance. So those are my concerns. Thank you.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually just a sort of clarification question to follow up on what Representative Pinto said, because what I heard you say is if somebody was outside and had a lawful permit to carry and a handgun that it would detect them. And then I think you said that would also detect if they had a permit. And could you explain how that is?
Sure. It actually came from, to the chair, came from in the military where you identify friend versus foe in jungle warfare. And so you would look for those things that would be identified. In this case, if the weapon is detected, after the weapon is detected, the person who has the threat is then provided to the officials. And so they can, once that is determined, we also can look at the database for permits and can connect the permits to the weapon. But we can give them that notification early.
Representative Greenman, just I want to point out to you that a Minnesota concealed carry permit does not allow you to enter a school. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the hypothetical is you are outside the school.
Walking outside.
Outside the school. And but so just so that I'm clear, because there's not, as far as I know, there's not a facial recognition permit list. Like you would, there's not a list that has people's faces that you could match up with surveillance that you would have from this. So, right? I mean, I'm assuming.
Dr. Childs. Right. Yes. To the chair. The facial recognition is an option that you don't have to use. But in some organizations, such as the U.S. Olympics, we do use the facial recognition for terrorists so we can recognize them before they get to the venue. But for the schools, I understand it's an option that does not have to be used.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess with learning more about this technology, it really concerns me, and I'm interested in what folks who think about civil liberties have been thinking about how we balance people's rights to be on the street, to exercise their Second Amendment rights, and the safety concerns. It also just, and I really appreciate what you said about, you know, the technology and the it coming out of the military, like, and being able to recognize friend or foe in general warfare, and what it means that we are allowing the kinds of weapons and the kinds of threats that are in general warfare, and we need to create technology and bring in now the technology of surveillance that we're using in general warfare. That's less of a question to you, and that's more of a question for us policymakers of, let's talk about the warfare and the weapons of war, not bringing in more technology of warfare. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative and testifiers. Just curious about looking at, when we're talking about some of the data that's collected, I'm curious what the requirements are, if they're already established somewhere else in statute, or if it would need to be clarified here, kind of going off of what Representative Feist was saying, like, are there provisions we might need to add here to ensure that plans aren't available to the public in a way that could make schools more vulnerable, knowing what their safety practices are? There are bad actors who we would not want to get that information, and if that's something that we would want to add, that we might need to have that discussion in judiciary.
Representative Bakeburn.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So school safety plans, I've worked in multiple school districts. That plan is never public. So for the reasons that you just talked about, you know, we have lots of layers of protection that we do in every school that I've worked with. We don't publicize that plan. We work with our partners to make sure that we're able to implement plans, but we don't publicize the plan for the reasons that you just talked about. So I would see this as just another layer of protection, a very discreet layer of protection for our kids in Minnesota.
Representative Ream.
Thank you, Chair Novotny, and thank you, Representative Bakeburn, for bringing this bill forward. I have some concerns about the cost, knowing that we have a pretty tight budget. You know, we're still looking to hire more educators. We need more funding for our schools. And knowing we have, 3,100 schools in the state of Minnesota, I'm curious how much $4 million, like, would that cover the cost of an average school's security, or how far would $4 million go for this pilot project? I'm just kind of curious.
Representative Bakeburn.
So the pilot project covers, the $4 million covers the eight different types of schools across the eight congressional districts across the state of Minnesota, and we need to have large and small representation so that we have good feedback, so that we are able to make good, informed decisions. So this is, I'm glad, Representative Ream, you asked about the cost piece of it, because there is a cost. There is a cost every single day. So we can make the choice about investing in critical infrastructure to keep our kids safe. So we, on the House floor, we could look at one-time funding, and that's what this would be for this pilot. We heard about $100 million that are sitting in a housing fund right now. We heard about We've heard about $70 million in debt service for the state office building. We have money for a train that is not going to happen, that we took money from last year to pay for UI. That's one-time funding buckets that are available. We could look at some creative buckets of funding. We could, you know what, we could rely on our schools to hold bake sales. We could do car washes. We could do fruit sales. We could even sell the little gift cards that kids go around door to door. Or we could pass House File 3490, pass the SGO bill, that are federal tax dollars that we could use to keep our schools safe as well. Or we could look at some of the buckets of ongoing funding. We have $8 million that the Department of Ed carried forward from the previous biennium into this year. And I've heard there are millions of dollars in our different department budgets. We can do this if we want to. We can find these dollars. We can reprioritize these dollars to keep our kids safe. So $4 million, in my opinion, is a very good investment to put a pilot in place so that we can make informed decisions.
Thank you, Representative Bakeberg. Members, we can circle back to this later, but right now we're going to go to some of the citizens that signed up to testify. Starting with Maren Hofer, if you could come up to the table. Each testifier will have maximum 2 minutes, and testimony will have to be on the content of the bill. If you stray from the content of the bill, you will be cut off. Representative Grayman, while he's doing that, I just want to add that Israeli bandages and tourniquets are also things that are designed for war, and they can be quite helpful if used properly. Mr. Hofer, state your full name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you so much, Chair Novotny, and committee members. My name is Maren Christensen-Hofer. I'm the executive director for the Multicultural Autism Action Network, which is a nonprofit that serves families of children with disabilities in multicultural communities. I'm also a parent of a child with a disability. And we could not agree more strongly on the needs to keep our students safe. This issue is personal for us here. My own child attended Annunciation in kindergarten through second grade. He's an eighth grader now, and we don't go to that school anymore. But many of those kids who were injured on that day are eighth graders and were his classmates. So this does hit really close to home. And we are absolutely in favor of practices to improve school safety, but we're concerned that this bill and its reference to predictive analytics and AI-driven tools is not the way to go. We were not able to find a lot of peer-reviewed research that demonstrates that AI and predictive analytics are effective threat detection schools and safe in detection tools in schools. We were, however, able to find plenty of evidence about bias and misidentification in the use of these AI tools, and this is particularly concerning in the disability community, where so many of the characteristics of disability, like lack of eye contact, repetitive moments, difficulty following instructions, those things are often perceived as threats, and that worries us. We would really suggest that before we move forward with any programs involving AI, that we have a real community conversation about how we're going to mitigate those risks to marginalized communities. How is threat behavior going to be determined and by whom? And how are we going to make sure we don't fall into the trap of what we've seen in the past, where we're misidentifying students with disabilities as a threat? We're also really concerned about prioritizing funding for this tool at a time when districts are, you know, seeing so many cuts, and certainly we're very sympathetic to what's happening as far as budgets. But we know that, you know, school counselors, mental health support, bullying prevention measures, suicide prevention measures, those are things that are actually evidence-based to reduce threats in schools. So that's the conversation that we'd like to have. We'd urge you to just hit the pause button and let's have a real conversation about how to keep our schools safe. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you. Next up will be John Bowler of ACLU. And then Pringle from Stand Up is up next, if you could be on deck. State your full name for the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Public Safety Committee. My name is John Beeler. I'm the Policy Counsel with the ACLU of Minnesota, testifying today in opposition to HF 3753. The ACLU has a report from 2023 on the dangers of school surveillance technology and the dangerous claims companies in the space are making. As of 2023, education surveillance is over a $3 billion industry with limited to non-existent track record of success. Studies and investigations conducted by the ACLU, the United States Department of Justice, and the Secret Service have shown that despite industry claims to the contrary, there's no evidence that surveillance technology makes schools safer. And to clarify, that is no evidence that is independent, unbiased, and data-driven. There is industry studies that show that that is successful. And on the contrary, the harm this technology causes to students is not in doubt. Among other issues, the technology increases feelings of anxiety, fear, and paranoia. It disincentivizes students to report at-home abuse or mental health issues with educators and support staff, and it diverts financial resources that truly work to promote student safety, such as school belonging, mental health supports, and anti-bias initiatives. Over-reliance on surveillance has been shown to result in disproportionate discipline of BIPOC students, LGBTQ students, and undocumented students or students with undocumented family members. These technologies threaten the rights of every student in Minnesota to an education free from discrimination as guaranteed by the Minnesota Constitution and the Minnesota Human Rights Act. We are concerned as well that a bill like this did not make any stops at any education committees to allow members with relevant experience and the advocacy groups that monitor those committees to have a say. Finally, not in my prepared remarks, but we are also concerned that the bill as drafted seems to envision an open request for proposals process, and yet we are hearing about a specific technology from a specific company, and if that's $4 million is being directed towards one company or if there is only one company in the market, then the Minnesota public deserves to know that. We appreciate your time. We urge the committee to oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, please state your name and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Kulia Pringle. I work directly with families across Minnesota navigating school systems and advocating for equitable outcomes. I'm here today to raise concerns about House File 3753. While I know this bill is intended to improve school safety, the approach raises serious issues for equity, privacy, and student rights. I want to start by saying this clearly. We all want safe schools. The pain behind this bill is real. The fear families carry is real, but good intentions do not always lead to good policy, and this proposal raises serious concern. This bill proposes threat assessments and AI-driven surveillance. Research shows that threat assessments often disproportionately impact Black students and students with disabilities, and predictive AI can only use past data. It cannot innovate. This means bias can be scaled, not corrected. Some have described the system as parameter-only and limited to weapon detection, but the bill's language said it must integrate with existing school security system. In practice, this could allow monitoring inside schools, continuous tracking, and the data sharing across systems or agencies. We cannot rely on intent alone. We must look at what the bill actually allows, because that is what will affect our students. Finally, it's interesting that Representative Bakeberg said that when we want to find money, we can find it. And yet, this bill directs substantial funding to surveillance systems at a time when schools are already losing counselors, mental health supports, and special education resources. Real school safety comes from trusted adults, relationships, counseling, and mental health supports, not technology that watches our children. For these reasons, I urge this committee to really look into this policy. As written, we can and must find solutions that protect children without putting them at greater risk of surveillance, bias, and inequity. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, Aaron Sandsmark. State your name and begin your testimony.
Hello, Chair and committee members. My name is Aaron Sandsmark. I'm the Executive Director of Solutions Not Suspensions Coalition. Or SNS is a dedicated organization to dismantling the school-to-prison pipeline. I'm testifying today in opposition to House File 3753. Though we appreciate the intent of this bill, as previously stated by other testimonies, we have strong concerns, though, over its consequences and the process for which it has moved through this body. I'm thankful that the intent of this bill is to protect our children. There is no doubt that we need our schools to be safe learning environments for every child, and that every child deserves an education that does not come with fear from outside actors. However, this legislation in our eyes does not tackle the issues on school safety the way we think it would be in the best interest for our children. This legislation would create a pilot program that would rely on surveillance methods and threat assessments to predict potentially dangerous behaviors or actors. Taking $4 million in our state budget that we think should be spent within our schools supporting our children directly, like counselors, as previously stated, mental health professionals, and other really important, vital support professionals. Beyond those concerns, I asked this committee, why was this bill not heard in education finance or education policy? This pilot program directly focuses on school safety, and with the discussions that the House has had this session on this very topic, I'm concerned that this bill has circumvented those bodies. Was there concern that this bill would not move forward if brought to those bodies? Additionally, what was the process in working with this outside vendor? What was the legislative oversight to outside contractor bids for this work? As raised by the ACLU, the vendor with TLC system seems to be pre-selected. They might very well be the right choice, but what is the process? The state of Minnesota and our residents need to know what the process is when we spend $4 million on a program like this. Thank you so much for your time. I hope you hear our valid concerns, and thank you for your time. Thank you.
Thank you. Going back to member discussion, Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple of comments to the developer of the system. Thank you for working, thinking out of the box and trying to come up with a solution. I don't think I'm going to ask a question, but you're welcome to sit there. This is a pilot project, and all the concerns that I've heard can be addressed during a pilot project is something that you do to try out a new system and find the flaws and fix the flaws. It's not something that's been around for a long time, so of course there's going to be some concerns, but it is a pilot project. And $4 million, I think it's $500,000 a school, and that's, you know, it's a new technology. I'm sure if we start implementing it, like all technology, will go down in cost. I just think it's great that you're thinking out of the box. I really appreciate you bringing this forward. And, you know, I call them whataboutisms. I call them something different, but that's not really PC to say in a committee meeting. So I love these questions, but that's what a pilot project does, is looks for flaws, works it up so it can eventually be mass introduced. So that's my comment. Thank you.
Representative Woody.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. Thank you, Representative Bakeberg, for bringing this bill and looking at other approaches to school safety. Obviously, our kids learn better when they're safe in schools. The one piece I'm just going to reframe this all at, I work for the Minnesota Twins. When you walk through those gates, that's IA detecting that as you go through there. And I know a lot of my colleagues will go to the games, and that's how they detect if you have a weapon on you. I'm going to also tell you, it's good enough for the Capitol because it's at every entrance we have right here. So I appreciate you looking at ways and explaining this to us. I echo what Representative Bliss says. This is a pilot program where it'll allow us to figure out these other pieces. So I don't think any of our data as we come through those doors, or many of the people in this room today came through, were concerned about that. So thank you.
Representative Tabke.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I have seen the demonstration of this, so I've been through that, so thank you. But I just have to disagree with Representative Witte. Like, this is not the same technology that's at the Twins. This is a very different type of technology, much more with radar, with other types of technologies that are in there. And so while this is, yes, a pilot program that is being provided here, that is funded by taxpayers, I think it's really important that we also know and have a good discussion about how data can be used and how we're protecting our kids and how this is not going to a Twins game. This is going to school, and it's a different thing. And I also, while I'm here, I would be remiss if I say that this is not addressing the issue of guns that we have in our community. We need to make sure that we are also addressing not just school safety, not just one silo of things. This is not doing anything, and we have failed so far in this committee and in this legislature to do anything with gun safety, and we have to do something to address guns in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bakeberg, I wanted to follow up on the questions I was asking earlier. I guess I'll say I know that some of our members attended a demonstration of technology that showed that weapons can be detected from even from a great distance away. I have concerns about the structure of the bill. We're lacking guardrails for how schools can use the technology and how come in and concerns that I have about and have been addressed by testifiers regarding bias, et cetera. I guess I'm concerned, though, that if the point back is to say, oh, no, there won't be bias and distinctions made by the technology, I guess I heard from Mr. Childs that you know, if somebody's walking by a school and they have a gun on them, then that's we're not going to make a distinction. Then police are going to be called, and then the permit issue will be addressed later. And I guess I'm just trying to understand from you, you know, schools in the city have sidewalks. I mean, people walk by all the time. Is it your intention here to have any permit holder then is going to have the police called on them when they walk by a school? I'm just trying to make sure I'm understanding what your intention is in this bill.
Dr. Childs?
I'll take that. So the intent of the bill is to make sure that threats stay outside of the school.
Yeah.
So this is what I do every day in my professional role, is to make sure kids are safe at school. So if I get a notification that there is a threat coming into my building, I will go out and I will meet that threat to make sure that the kids in my building are safe. Every single principal that I know will do that, because our first priority is to keep kids safe. So oftentimes, and it was said, that we have relationships with our community. So we will be able to have conversations with the community member walking up to be able to address, because that person may not even realize that they have a weapon on them. The example I gave about a student, that has happened countless times in my professional career, where a kid has walked into the building and panicked because they've had something on them that they shouldn't have on them. So the intent of the bill is to make sure that school staff are notified in unison with their school safety plan, and then we would implement the school safety plan and go into the protocols that are needed as outlined in our school safety plan.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you. Representative Bakeberg, I appreciate that. That's not consistent with the way the technology was described. The way the technology was described in the particular case of a company that I believe is advancing this, and we heard the discussion of it, is that, and I think this is part of the promise of it, is, you know, you bring a gun near a school, then the technology is going to identify that, and police are going to be notified. There'll be the chance later on to figure out if you have a permit. But that's how that's described. So I understand what you're saying. But I don't think that that's consistent with your intent. And, I mean, the bill does need a fair amount of work. I think it's helpful for us to be thinking in these ways. But I think we do want to just consider whether the implications of that. You talk about somebody walking up to the school, but you also say that, hey, when there's external to the school, somebody's on the sidewalk outside. That happens all the time, I think, as permit holders walk by. So that's a concern that I have in how you're structuring it. Looks like you have something to say.
So I want to just address that specifically. So if there's a permit holder walking by in the front of a school, what any school staff would do is walk toward the front door and watch that person, because I would be notified that that person is walking by the school. So if the person would be in the range, then I would stand there and I would watch that person. Mm-hmm. If the person walks toward the front door of the building where there are children, then I would engage with that person. So it is not infringing on anyone's rights. It is keeping kids safe. That's the intent of this bill, and I'm happy to work on language, very happy to do that. So, that is how it would happen in real life.
And, Mr. Chair, final point. I know you want to move on.
Representative Pinto, briefly.
I'll just note, so that alert in the first place, though, the way that your bill is drafted now, that would be public data, and so there would be a record of all the permit holders walking by those schools. Just something for folks to keep in mind. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenman. Yes, we have one testifier that was missed. Peppercorn, please come to the table, state your name, begin your testimony. You have 2 minutes.
Yeah. Good afternoon, chairs and committee members. My name is Marika Pfeffercorn. I live in North Minneapolis, and I'm a resident of House District 59B. I am also a representative of the Notice Coalition, which you should have received a letter, and the Twin Cities Innovation Alliance. I'm testifying today to share our deep expertise on the civil rights consequences of emerging technologies. We explore and research public education, artificial intelligence audits, policy and advocacy and technology, and legal strategies when it comes to artificial intelligence, particularly around safety and in schools. The intended purpose of this bill is to keep kids safe. Can we all agree on that? Mm-hmm. We have a common goal to work from. And if we take this goal very seriously, we have an opportunity to explore more deeply a real evidence-based strategy to do so. This is why I'm here in opposition to House File 3753. Here's what we do know about threat assessments and artificial intelligence and what has been proposed in this legislation. School threat detection technology integrated with AI and predictive analytics or not violates privacy, due process, and equal protection under the law, as referenced in our submitted letter, which highlights several federal state cases. In this letter, we highlight our concerns about these legal and ethical challenges and provide those resources for you to reference. First, what we know, scientifically, this proposal is not scientifically validated. The Federal Trade Commission found 50% error rate with threat assessments, including or not artificial intelligence. Schools across the country are abandoning similar systems due to persistent misidentification and performance-based issues both inside and outside of schools and including buses. There are persistent performance-based issues that have already been referenced about chips, lunchboxes, this is outside of the school, guns were drawn on elementary age students because of this mistake. This has happened across the country and it is in the news. Algorithmic discrimination. Research has found that students receiving special education and black students are disproportionately represented in threat assessments both in and out of schools, most classified as non-serious, which are human intelligence addresses. Student data privacy. Student privacy guidance from the U.S. Department of Education indicates that data from school cameras inside and out directly relating to individual students and their families constitutes legally protected educational records on the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, also known as FERPA. Such records cannot be disclosed to third-party vendors without prior parental consent. This includes AI weapons detection frequently. But before I leave you today, I want to share with you a story about human surveillance and intelligence that is making the case for what's happening on the ground in protecting our young people. The Conflict Resolution Center was providing restorative services to a number of high schools and community schools across the state. This fall, they were receiving services by this organization. A student approached this external community partner and said, "On the bus ride home from school today, I heard a student say that they left a gun outside of the school because they knew there was not a camera there." The student was afraid to come forward. She feared for her life. But she had relationship, and she had a trusting relationship with her administrator and with her peers in that classroom. She took the risk and told them about that gun that was not captured by intel that was through technology, because people move when they understand technology.
Ms. Pfeffercorn, you're at
3 minutes.
They
were able to de-escalate. And my final point about privacy with cameras, Minneapolis Public Schools, their entire safety protocol and program was revealed during their when they had the, attack. Thank you very much for your time and attention. I appreciate you all keeping our kids safe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one quick question and then I'll make some comments. So is the cost per school
Representative Bakeberg, $500,000 per school. I know Representative Ream asked that question, and I didn't hear how much it would cost for each individual school. I understand this is a pilot, but.
Representative Bakeberg.
The cost is $4 million for the entire pilot project. There are eight different schools across the state from the eight different congressional districts that would be part of the pilot, both big and small. So the $4 million is the cost for the entire pilot project.
Chair Moeller.
Okay, thanks. So I guess I'm hearing yes, with eight schools, it would be $500,000 per school. I don't realize this is just a pilot. That's over $1 billion, I believe, though, if it were to be implemented in every single school in the state. I do have some concerns about the predictive AI aspect. Those have been expressed already. And I also have some concerns about the fact that this hasn't gone through the Judiciary Committee. I do think there are some data practices questions surrounding this bill. I don't know with this data if it's public, if it's private. Anything's presumptively public if it's not specifically stated or falling into another category. I think it's a little unclear here, so I think that's another committee stop that's needed. I've heard folks express that they were frustrated it didn't go to Education Finance Committee. I'll note the bill was introduced in February. And then finally, I'll just say, you know, I know in your comments you talked about this being one part of a layered approach, but that's leaving out we're not talking about the actual guns again. A layered approach should also actually include these weapons of war that my colleagues have spoken about already. And then also just some concerns about, not really concerns, but just making the point that mass shootings, if we were to actually address the guns, that would impact mass shootings not just at schools, but at movie theaters, at malls, at churches, all of those other places as well. And that's why I think including the guns in the conversation is really essential when we talk about this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'll have a brief comment that I didn't feel violated today as I walked over to the Capitol and walked past security and watched my staff members go through screenings. And I don't believe that was run through Judiciary or anything else either. Representative Bakeberg, brief closing.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Moeller, members, for a good discussion. The bill, this is a very simple bill that aims to keep kids safe in school, teachers safe in school in a proactive manner that uses technology. And this is one aspect of a layered approach. And we have to be focused on solutions that we can actually agree to. And that is why I brought this bill forward, to be able to continue to move the conversation to keep our kids safe. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, House File 3753 is laid over. Thank you, Representative Bakeberg. The next bill on the agenda is House File 4299. Representative Steer, please come to the table with your testifiers. Representative Steer moves House File 4299 before the committee. Representative Steer, please begin your testimony and have your testifier identify themselves.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'll be brief to get us back on schedule here. So House File 4299, it's an appropriation of $1 million in fiscal year 2026. From the general fund of the Commissioner of Public Safety for eight school safety specialists for the Minnesota School Safety Center. I do wish that this was a continuing appropriation of money. Money is tight right now, so I'm asking for $1 million to get this thing started. And with that, I'll push it off to the School Safety Center specialists.
Thank you. Looks like Allison Farrell. Please begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. I am Allison Farrelly, the Director of the Homeland Security and Emergency Management Division, which includes and oversees the School Safety Center. So here I wanted to just give a little overview of what the School Safety Center does every day right now as how we are formed. And currently we are a non-regulatory program that was established and funded by the Minnesota Legislature to serve as a free resource for K through 12 public, private, public charter, and tribal schools across the state. The focus on to help them prepare, mitigate, respond, and recover from all hazard emergencies. Currently, the staffing level, we have one director and seven full-time staff members in the school safety center. As I mentioned, we are a non-regulatory organization that works at partnership-based. And so a lot of things that we cover when we are working with those schools includes coaching and guiding and technical assistance around developing those school emergency operations plans as that were mentioned earlier. We do emergency operations, those plan reviews. We also help with behavioral threat assessment and management, emergency response protocol training, do tabletop or exercise facilitation, other training for professional development for staff. We also recently were able to work with schools and school resource officers to roll out training for school resource officers, and are also just building that relationship around getting them to understand the different opportunities for connecting through for behavioral threat assessment and management and other opportunities to ensure the schools are safe and secure.
Questions for Representative Steer.
Mr. Chair, I do have a testifier. He was the wrong list. I apologize.
All right, testifier, begin your name and state your name.
Paul, my name is Paul Winkelar. I'm a former ninth grade civics teacher in Farmington and currently work at Education Minnesota. I'm here to express my support for this provision investing $1 million additional safety specialists at the Minnesota Safety Center within the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. From an educator's perspective, this is a practical and meaningful step towards safer schools. By adding eight specialists, schools across Minnesota will have greater access to expert guidance and threat assessment, emergency planning, and prevention strategies. This is especially important because effective school safety is not just about responding to crises. It's about identifying risks early and putting systems in place to prevent incidents before they occur. Educators strongly value training that is clear and consistent and grounded in best practices. These specialists provide that support. When educators know what to do in a crisis, it reduces anxiety and allows us to focus on our primary role, helping students learn and succeed. This investment also promotes equity. Smaller and rural districts often lack the internal resources to help develop comprehensive safety plans. Expanding the capacity of the Minnesota School Safety Center ensures that all schools, regardless of size or location, can access the same level of expertise and support. Finally, this funding recognizes that school safety includes student well-being. Many safety concerns stem from unmet mental health needs or escalating situations that could be addressed earlier with the right intervention. Safety specialists help schools build behavior threat and assessment management systems, and these multidisciplinary teams help students with the support they need before problems become emergencies. In closing, thank you for this bill, Representative Steer. This is a thoughtful preventative investment and supports teachers, protects students, and strengthens schools across Minnesota.
Once again, I apologize for the mix-up. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ferrol, just want to ask you, so the bill right now is set up to have just a one-time money, and can you talk about how that would work with funds that would be only for 1 year and hiring eight specialists? I would think that would kind of be a problem.
Definitely. Yes.
Ms. Ferrol.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. So the bill currently is a one-time funding of $1 million, and in assessment with my school safety center team, you know, this is an issue just because it is a one-time. By the time we hire these eight specialists, we would be out of that time allotment to be able to have more money to continue the salaries of those personnel. So really it would make more sense if for a special project in that way, and not necessarily we need to look at long-term funding for those staff members. And also we're concerned about, you know, if it would actually cover eight people, just with salary and fringe and just what the mid-range level usually is around that position. You know, so that's really where our concern sits right now.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Ferrol, is this part of the governor? This is not part of the governor's budget proposal, is it?
So in the governor's budget proposal, we did put together a $5 million ask. So it includes more staff and then also a school safety grant program. So currently looking, we've asked for about $4.5 million. That would be a school safety grant program. to be able to provide funding opportunities for schools to be able to do more plan development or training or exercising or even school facility augmentation. That funding would also ensure that we are able to hire personnel to manage that grant, and then we put in about $435,000 to add three more staff members. So it's not eight, but looking to add more staff members to the school safety center to ensure that we are continuing our reach and trying to grow what we can do for the school safety center.
Okay, and the final question, Mr. Thank you. And so, Representative Stewart, I think you maybe anticipated my question. You had questions to Representative Frazier yesterday. He had a proposal to have funding for the BCA, and you said, hey, that's not something the governor is proposing, so that's not something that you're advancing. How do you respond then with the fact that you're doing the same thing today?
Representative Steer.
Sure, I believe you just said to ask us for $5 million, and the governor's proposal was less than $5 million. I believe it was 1.5 or so. So my ask is $1
million. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm trying to understand. So you're saying you're asking for less of a funding increase than the governor is asking for. Is that right?
Yeah,
with the
current budget, I believe $1 million, and we can continue funding on this. I believe we're going to both be here next year, so continued funding next year and on to the future.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. But I get Representative Steer, but it sounds from Ms. Farrell that the what the governor's proposing to spend the money on is quite different. It sounds like the plan would be to hire a couple people, but not to do what you're looking for. So I understand your total request or total proposal is less than the governor's proposing, but the governor's going to be buying a lot of other things that you wouldn't be buying with yours. So again, how do you justify that you're saying we should add a lot more people to this part of the agency than the agency itself is asking for, given your point from yesterday?
Sure. Representative Steer.
Yeah, I think both bills are being laid over, so there's plenty of time to work on both those bills and figure out where we want to spend the money.
Fair enough. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Steer, and I'll let Representative Frazier know your openness as well to that. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, House File 4299 is laid over. Next bill on the agenda is House File 4700. Representative Steer will remain at the table. Representative Steer moves that House File 4700 come before the committee. Representative Steer, please begin your testimony and have your testifiers introduce themselves to the committee.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 4700 is not a new bill. This bill was heard last year in committee. It received partial funding, and I'm back at the table today to ask for the full funding for police training. It's a Philando Castillo training fund. This was established, I believe, in 2020. This is critical training funds for law enforcement across the state. And with that, I'll pass it off to the testifiers.
First one I have on the list is Sheriff DeGeorge. State your name, begin your testimony.
Chair Novotny, Chair Moeller, members of the committee. My name is John DeGeorge. I am the elected sheriff of Fillmore County, Minnesota. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association representing all 87 elected sheriffs. In 2018, an agreement was established between the legislature and the law enforcement community. This agreement stipulated that officers would receive essential training in areas such as use of force, crisis response, cultural diversity, conflict management, and autism awareness. In return, the state committed to providing reliable annual funding to support this training. It is crucial that we honor this commitment, both in principle and with actual funding. The current proposal, which reduces the fund to just $1 million, represents an 82% cut. This is not merely a budget adjustment. It is a retreat from the state's promise and poses a significant threat to equitable access to professional development for our law enforcement officers throughout Minnesota. This impact is especially pronounced for small and rural agencies. Approximately 70% of Minnesota's law enforcement departments have fewer than 20 officers. And for many of them, this fund is their only resource for meeting the state's training requirements. Without sufficient funding, these departments will face serious challenges in compliance, preparedness, and public engagement. Since 2020, more than 30 police reform bills have passed through this legislature, many of which are dependent on comprehensive officer training. Additionally, recent mandates, such as the new requirement for school resource officer training, have further increased the training burden. These reforms cannot succeed without consistent investment. We are not asking for new funding, but rather for the state to uphold a commitment that was already made. It's also important to recognize the significance of the fund's name. The Flandreau Castile Memorial Training Fund was created to symbolize our collective resolve for meaningful change in law enforcement practices. Underfunding this initiative not only jeopardizes training and accountability goals, but also threatens to undermine the powerful legacy and intention behind its name. Ladies and gentlemen, in 2018, there was an unanimous understanding among our state legislators, our law enforcement leaders, and our community that we wanted and expected our law enforcement officers to be more competent, more capable, and better prepared for the dynamic and challenging job that they do each day to ensure that they've made good decisions when life and safety depended on it. The formula for that to succeed is very simple, and it requires two things: good people and good training. If we do not honor that agreement and maintain the previous commitment to training funding, we can expect officers to be less prepared, less competent, and less confident in their own decision-making and abilities in the stressful situations that they no doubt will face. That would be unacceptable to the public that we serve, and it should be unacceptable to all of us as well. The Minnesota Sheriff's Association thanks Representative Steer for bringing this bill forward. I want to make sure I just state one more time that this is not a request for new funding from us. We're just asking the legislature to please not depart from the commitment that was made to provide the funding that we need to provide the training that we know that we all want to have. Thank you for your time and consideration. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Chief Henthorne, state your name, begin your testimony.
Jay Henthorne. Good afternoon, Chair Novotny and Mueller. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon. My name is Jay Henthorne. I'm the Chief of Police for the City of Richfield and the current President of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. I am speaking today on behalf of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, who represents more than 300 police chiefs across the state of Minnesota and over 100 command staff members. I want to thank Representative Steer for bringing this bill forward. House File 4700 is a very important bill for agencies across the state. This bill provides the critically needed funding for several state mandated trainings that every police officer needs to attend to maintain their police officer license. The funding included in this bill can only be used for the following mandated trainings: use of force, training in crisis response, conflict management, cultural diversity, and autism training. We believe the training requirements mentioned above play a significant role in developing and maintaining relationships with communities and their local law enforcement by preparing police officers with the necessary skills to address any situation that they may encounter in the field. 70% of the police departments in Minnesota are very small, with less than 20 officers. For most small agencies, for them, the Philando Castile Memorial Training Fund represents their sole source of training funds. If this fund is not extended, we may not be able to cover the cost of these mandated training courses that are so imperative in today's policing throughout the state. Without this funding, training will be an unfunded state mandate and become a financial burden on local property taxes. I am here today representing all police chiefs, but I am specifically here to express the need for small agencies who simply do not have the funding to keep up with all the mandated training requirements if the Philando Castile Memorial Training Fund is not extended. Since this fund was created in 2017, we have recognized the importance of having a well-trained law enforcement workforce. This training is vitally important to keeping our police officers trained on these important skills. However, the cost associated with attending these specific courses is not sustainable without the assistance of the Philando Castile Memorial Training Fund. Thank you for the opportunity to testify here today, and we look forward to continued conversations on this vitally important bill. Thank you.
And a final testifier, welcome back to committee. Go ahead, Ms. Castile. State your name and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and legislative body. My name is Valerie Castile. I'm Philando Castile's mother. The Philando Castile Training Fund is essentially important at a time when police departments across the country are closing, merging, or losing funding because reduced resources often lead to less training, not fewer responsibilities. I support the training funds because I believe education, communication, and accountability are necessary steps to prevent future loss of life and to create a safer interaction between police and the community. I have repeatedly stressed that proper training is essential to prevent deadly mistakes, especially when officers are under increased stress and covering large areas. We need this extra training for our police because at the end of the day, everybody wants to go home. As departments close and remaining officers face heavier workloads, the risk of miscommunication increases. Supporting training funds aligns with those values by investing in learning, responsibility, and long-term change rather than retaliation. Decreasing in funding can lead to less comprehensive training, which may increase the risk of harmful encounters. Pulling resources away does not fix the system. It can make it worse by leaving officers less prepared to respond safely and appropriately within our communities. Communication and dialogue can prevent tragedies. With the proper training and being able to have a dialogue with a person, you can come to a resolution where everyone goes home. I've made it clear that supporting the training fund is about protecting the future, not just honoring my son. This isn't about my son anymore. It's about the next generation of children. Withdrawing funds would only increase the risk of miscommunication and violence. It's a disservice to law enforcement and to the community. They need this protected. They need to be protected well. In a time when police departments are struggling to stay open and adequately staffed, the Philando Castile Police Training Fund helps ensure that safety, accountability, and human life remain priorities rather than casualties or budget cuts. I'll close by saying how difficult it has been for me to watch all the hard work and accomplishments that we have made in public safety to be disregarded and disrespected by ICE. I'm glad to see there are conversations now. I know our institutions have tried to be supportive. It's not what you do, it's how you do it. Thank you for letting me testify today.
Thank you, and we understand. Members, brief questions for Representative Steer. We have four bills to do yet. Co-Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for bringing this bill, and it's good to see you, Ms. Castile, again. I just have some questions about the numbers because I'm just confused a little bit about how the bill is drafted and some of the comments that were made in the, particularly the letter of support from the different law enforcement agencies. So I'll first just say, like, we all think this training is really important and good, so I'll just start by that. I just want to try to get at an explanation for what we funded in the past and what the actual request is this year. So I know the one letter said that the legislature removed base appropriation funding, and I don't know that that's accurate. I don't know if Mr. Walls can maybe answer that question for us.
Mr. Walls.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mueller, over the course of the year, there had been, or the year's recent history, there have been several appropriations for police training, both the overall, the general pot of money for police training and what is now called the Philando Castile Fund. However, due to budget constraints or priorities or however you want to look at it, those funds were not always given with full tails. So this, the legislature has been adding on a year-by-year basis most years to these training funds and has not included permanent funding. If one were to look at how the bill is structured, I believe it's changing the tails. So on line 3.7, the base for that this activity is 878 is crossed out, and it had been in the year before that 4,942,000. So someone could look at that and say that the legislature reduced it from the 4942 to 878. But the actual way one would look at it is we provided 4,942,000 in a year that was zero. And in the year beginning in 2028, that was zero as well, and we provided 878 because that was what was available in the target. So these weren't reductions. These were new dollars that were provided in the legislation that's being amended by this bill.
Co-Chair Mueller.
Yeah, thank you for that. That was my recollection, too, that we actually added to the base. And I did go back and look, and the request, I believe, from the bill last year was about $6 million each year. And I think we funded it at like 4.9, 4.2, and then added that amount to the base. And then but then this is also adding dollars under paragraph A at line 1.9 in $6 million. And I'm just curious where that number comes from. So if we were just working off the bill we had last year, it was, you know, $12 million. We funded it about $10 million. And so now I'm seeing the $6 million, and I'm not sure where that number is coming from on line 1.9.
Mr. Walls? Representative Steer.
This will call up Executive Director Jeff Potts with the Chiefs Association to explain it.
Director Potts. And Post Director Missel is coming up.
All right. And Post Board Director Eric Missel. You have the full team today. Thank you.
I don't know who's Director Missel. State your name, begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Eric Missel, I'm the Executive Director of the Post Board. And I believe I'm probably better to answer the question from Chair Mueller. And again, there is a base in the post budget that has been there for years, long before when I came in 2017, it was there, and that's a $2.49 million. That's been there forever. Then when the Philando Castile Fund was created, that was $6 million a year and has been reappropriated every year. As to the direct question, if I'm understanding it, my interpretation of that from the standpoint of when we do reimbursement is, for instance, for this year, we have $4.9 million, which was what the bill authorized last year, plus the $2.49 that is in the base, that in our what I call our base, the post-based, and we will be distributing that in reimbursement this year. Then for fiscal 28, it goes down to 878 plus the 2.49 million again that is has been in our base. I hope that answers the question.
Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I might be even more confused now. I'll just try to wrap it up because I know we can always follow up offline as well. So the training that's in line 1.19 to 1.12, is that separate from the Philando Castile training?
I don't have the bill in front of me, but I believe that is correct. Yes, that has been the base reimbursement annually appropriated had to be reappropriated. I may be crossing my term, so I apologize for that. But that is the base, and then this now is increasing that base to $6 million.
Okay, so it seems like the bill's requesting more than, Mr. Chair. Seems like the bill's requesting more than just training dollars through the Philando Castile Fund, the way it's drafted here. That's my understanding.
Executive Director Missel.
That would be my interpretation as well as to the, and again, these are two separate funds for, well, you know what, I'm not going to speculate. Yes.
Yes.
The answer is yes.
Okay. And I may have some other questions I can ask offline. I just needed to understand how the bill is drafted. Thank you.
Thank you. Director Potts.
Just to Mr. Chair and to Chair Mueller, I think what the goal here was, and the way it's written may be confusing, but I think the goal here, and our association supported this and helped work with it, was to simply restore what had been lost over the last couple of years. So restoring the base funding that Executive Director Missel talked about, and restoring what was reduced from what's technically called the Philando Castile Memorial Training Fund. I believe that the total of those two comes to about $3 million a year, and that's perhaps why you see the bill written the way it is. So it's really not to grow or add to the training fund, it's to restore what was lost.
Co-Chair Mueller.
that's the opposite of what I just thought. So I don't know if anybody else is confused, but I think that paragraph A is different from the Philando Castile paragraph B, and that's what I'm trying to understand. And I'm seeing Mr. Misselt saying yes, but it seems like you're saying they're one in the same.
All right. In the interest of being laid we do over, have so four more bills to go. This is a conversation that's getting thicker as it goes. Thank you. With that, we'll lay over House File 4700. Representative Witte. As the next bill, House File 4282. Vice Chair Witte, go to the table with your testifier. Begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair members. I'm here to present House File 4282 and the DEI-1 concerning medications provided to persons detained in jails. After significant collaboration with community stakeholders, the Minnesota Sheriff's Association and Department of Corrections, we have found clarifying language that addresses previously raised concerns with House File 4282. The amendment meets the operational realities of jail facilities while ensuring essential medical safeguards for those in custody. It is important to note that partnerships between the sheriff's community, stakeholders, and the Department of Corrections on this amendment. It clarifies implementation and ensures safe medical services that protect the lives of incarcerated individuals. And I have two testifiers.
Thank you. First up is Aiken County Sheriff Gudia.
Chair Novotny, it's Gaida. Thank you. Chair Moeller and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak here today. Again, good to see you. My name is Dan Gaida, and I serve as the elected sheriff of Aiken County. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, which represents all 87 Minnesota elected sheriffs. And I'm also here and represent the people that are incarcerated that couldn't be here today to keep their life safe. And I appreciate the work we've done on this bill so far. The Minnesota Sheriff's Association is pleased to support the amendment to House File 4282. The Minnesota Sheriff's Office, Sheriff's Association worked with our partners, stakeholders, jail administrators, sheriffs, community partners, county health care providers, and the Department of Corrections to reach an agreement on this amendment. The amended language ensures consistency, accountability, and most importantly, it'll protect those people in our facilities and save lives. Chair Novotny, Chair Moeller, and members, on behalf of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, the 87 electeds in the state, I respectfully ask for your support for House File 4282 as amended. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Next up is Deputy DOC Commissioner Khan.
Good afternoon, Chair Novotny and members of the committee. My name is Safia Khan, and I serve as the Deputy Commissioner of Corrections. I want to thank Vice Chair Witte for allowing all the various stakeholders the time and space to work through our differences on the original draft of the bill. I also want to express our gratitude for our partners at the Minnesota Sheriff's Association for working with us and the lead community stakeholders on the revised language before you today. This language is consistent with the interim guidance DOC currently has in place as we determine compliance against existing law. We believe it is reasonable and fair and support adding this clarity to our statutes. We know that progress in the space depends on continued partnership, and we are committed to continuing this work ahead in collaboration with our partners at the Sheriff's Association. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Questions for the testifiers or Representative Witte? Vice Chair Moeller, or Co-Chair Moeller.
I didn't even catch that. It's all right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank the stakeholders for all your work on this, Representative Witte, for you carrying this bill. I just want to make it clear on the record that we don't think there was anything wrong, unconstitutional, unlawful about the bill as passed last year, that we didn't have any negative feedback about that we were that was brought forward with the lawsuit and again this year. So just want to make that part of the record. So often when we enact legislation, we come back and make tweaks and clarity and all of that. This is very common as part of the process. It doesn't mean that this acknowledgement that there was anything wrong before. So I felt it was important to get that into the record as well. And, you know, I don't know, I think the lawsuit is still ongoing, and I certainly hope that this will give those who are suing pause and maybe they will withdraw from the lawsuit. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Well, it's been brought to my attention that we have a DE that wraps this all up and is a accumulation of all the work that's been done and the agreements that have been moved forward. Representative Witte, briefly to the DE-1.
This is the collaboration and work to make clarifying comments to make the bill work.
Thank you. Members, all in favor of the DE-1 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The DE-1 passed. Closing comments, Representative Witte.
Thank you, and thank you to the partners for working together on this.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
With that, we'll move 4282 will be laid over. Next bill on the agenda is 4139. That is my bill. Representative Witte, please come to the table.
I will move House File 4139 before the committee, and I see you have an amendment coded A1. Please explain your amendment, Chair Novotny.
The A1 amendment changes Section 2 of the bill. It removes the concept of appropriation to help pay for the counties who transitioned and took on state employee benefits above those transferable to the county and set the funding structure through the Department of Revenue. The amendment changes it to accept the concept of providing an account within the state of the state's Department of Corrections that can be used to fund those same extra benefits in transition from state to counties to ensure employees do not lose out of their earned benefits that are currently not transferable under the state statute. The intent of this bill was to set up a more transparent system for transfers, and this section allows for the funding to assist where we have heard concerns from both DOC and MAPE.
Thank you. Members, are there any questions for Chair Novotny on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, Chair Novotny moves adoption of the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Please begin your testimony, Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Vice Chair Witte. And in the for brevity, I will substantially cut my testimony and just say that this is a combination of a long process of transferring the systems and the way probation, parole were done with the state and who did what. And this is just the last thing that fell between the cracks, and we're hoping to clear that up. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you. Testifiers, identify yourself for the record and give your testimony on the bill. First up is Mike McMillan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Moeller and members of the committee. My name is Mike McMillan. I'm the director of the probation department in Wright County, and I've been involved in this work for over 40 years this year, so excited about that. House File 4139 is designed to provide a better framework and timeline for that notification of the change to CCA or whatever delivery system someone chooses to move to. Clarity is what benefits transfer, responsibility by entity for the agreements they make at either the local or state level, and appropriation to account for those benefits assumed by the transitions entity that are over and entitles capped benefit structure. You have an important letter, I believe, in the packet from key county stakeholders who support the important tenets of this bill that the bill represents. They include the Minnesota Association of Counties, Minnesota Intercounty Association, MICA, Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties, Minnesota Association of County Probation Officers. You have always prioritized your support for our work, and we thank you for making time for this important conversation today. Minnesota relies heavily on community supervision as a central component for public safety. Most individuals in our correction system are supervised in the community, making a strong, stable, and county administrative system is essential to public safety and outcomes across the state. As we continue the successful implementation of the single funding formula that allows for transition between state and counties, we have found some ambiguities that we think deserve some clarity that this bill addresses. Ensuring that employees impacted by the transition between supervision delivery systems are treated fairly and maintaining salary and recognizing years of service are critical to supporting a stable workforce. Retaining experienced staff and ensuring continuity of supervision and services. Also, this bill is structured to reinforce the principle that employees should be made whole during that transition. Responsibility for accrued leave and benefits obligations appropriately remain with the employing entity where those benefits were earned. I'll give you an example. In Wright County, our two different systems are an extreme, how we do benefits versus how the state do benefits, and we're going through this process. And it's been extremely cumbersome, confusing for staff, confusing for administrations, and we feel strongly that this will help clean this up. Like I said, we believe the clarity is in the statute to outline a process by which these counties can exercise their statutory authority in the delivery system. We've been currently waiting for 6 months in Wright County for the transition to take place, and we think that's way too long. And efforts like this for counties moving forward, and many will be moving forward in this transition, we believe, this bill will clean that up substantially. This is not about shortchanging or not valuing the work of probation that probation does. Wright County holds probation at a very high standard. We have the lowest turnover rate of any department in the county. We pay above market salaries. We have excellent benefits, training programs, anything that we can do not only to enhance our service but make the employees feel a part of the system and also provide good delivery of service. Additionally, as we have been talking with our partners in this work, namely Department of Corrections and MAPE, all important stakeholders that have worked on the single funding formula, we feel this is the last piece that will help pull it all together. In conclusion, thank you, Chair Novotny, for bringing this critical conversation forward. We thank you, Chair and Chair Moeller and members for prioritizing the importance of state and counties and the safety of our communities. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, Deputy Commissioner Kahn. Next, and then waiting at Devin Bruce.
Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. My name is Safia Khan, and I serve as a deputy commissioner at the DOC. House File 4139 raises important issues that we agree do need to be looked at. However, the DOC has concerns with the bill that stem from a broader system-level issue affecting community supervision across the state. This is a complex issue that intersects employment law, collective bargaining, and intergovernmental relationships, and we recognize that there are places in statute where additional clarity would certainly be helpful. In 2023, following the Justice Reinvestment Initiative, Minnesota adopted a new funding formula for community supervision. This reform was developed collaboratively by the department, counties, and many other stakeholders, and represented the first significant funding increase for supervision systems in decades. Throughout that process, there was a shared understanding that the new funding structure could result in counties transitioning between supervision delivery models, particularly into the CCA system. Minnesota law has long required that when employees move between systems, they do so at the same grade level and with the same benefits. That statutory framework was the starting point for the 2023 reforms. During the justice reinvestment process, additional protections were added to clarify expectations around items such as leave accruals. These protections were part of the broader agreement that allowed these reforms to advance. As counties have transitioned, practical and legal questions have emerged, questions about how to interpret the terms grade and benefits, how to reconcile differences between state and county compensation structures, and what obligations each system has when employees transfer. These issues are not unique to a single county. They are system-wide and affect all supervision models. There is ongoing litigation to some of these questions, and for that reason, the DOC cannot comment on the specifics of a specific county. But more broadly, the DOC believes that the proposed legislation is premature. While the bill attempts to respond to real concerns,
We do need to fully account for the complexity of the statewide system and maintain alignment among state and county partners. I do also want to acknowledge the good intentions and thoughtfulness behind the appropriation to DOC to pay out the benefits. However, it would not resolve the core challenge that we have with the bill. The DOC's priority is to ensure that regardless of transitions between systems, employees have a reliable safety net of their benefits, including access to accrued sick leave in the event of a medical event. Without that assurance, DOC staff who have served our communities are left without the protection of benefits that they have earned. Recently, the DOC has had productive conversations with our county partners. There appears to be shared recognition that a more comprehensive approach will be necessary, and we are committed to continuing that work. For these reasons, the DOC has concerns about the bill as currently drafted, and we would appreciate the opportunity to be part of these discussions and remain committed to working toward a balanced, thoughtful solution. Thank you, Chair and members.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Next up, Devin Bruce.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Devin Bruce. I am the Director of Legislative and Political Affairs for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, MAPE. We represent over 18,000 state professionals across all agencies, boards, and commissions, including those who are impacted by the transition from state DOC counties probation supervision service to what is now going to be potentially Wright County probation. After years of inequity between the state and county probation services, stakeholders from DOC, the counties, as well as labor came together to agree to a single funding formula. Contingent upon that was also recognizing the financial incentives, particularly to the counties, in transitioning from a MACPO, which is a mixed delivery system for state supervised felony probation services, and for the county to supervise the juvenile and gross misdemeanor cases in the communities. With the new single funding formula, there was a recognition that this would incentivize some counties to shift either to CCA or to state service, depending on where they fall, because of the incentives attached to the actual caseloads, in recognition that some cases require a little bit more oversight. For us, to agree to that, we ensured that what was true for the state when they were taking on county employees would also be true for the counties when they take on state employees. And that was assurances for both their accrual banks as well as their salary benefit levels. We certainly appreciate that the counties have come to the table to recognize some of these issues, but the fact still remains that they are stripping our employees of their accrued sick leave, which also not just is saved up for their past banks, but going forward as part of their retirement plan and folds into an HSA to take care of their medical needs after retirement. We also believe that this is premature due to the fact that there is active litigation, and we don't feel that this is the right time to address this in a very short session when other concerns are taking a lot of airtime. So we appreciate it and stand for any questions.
Thank you. Are there any brief comments by members?
Mr. Chair.
Chair.
I'd just like to say that we do have a lot of work to do, and it does sound like we need to do some work with the DOC to keep the promises that were made.
Chair Mueller, anything? Okay, with that, House File 4139 as amended is laid over. Thank you, Chair Novotny. Testifiers, the next bill on the agenda is House File 3530. Representative Duran, please come to the testifiers table with your testifiers. This pilgrim is on.
I will move House File 3530 before the committee. Representative Duran, to see you have an amendment coded A1. Please describe your amendment.
The amendment, thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment gets me into the shape that I want with the not just narrowing it to Belchamie County, but all the affected areas and the disaster that happened in June over the summer.
Does he have your testifier state his name and begin his testimony?
Oh, okay. You want to adopt it?
So that will do that.
Okay.
I'm watching the clock and getting nervous. Any questions on the amendment? All in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. Motion carries and the amendment is adopted. Please begin your testimony briefly, Representative Duran.
All right, we'll make this quick. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee, for the opportunity to speak on House File 3530. This bill would exempt eligible areas from the state cost share requirement that is for the disaster assistance reimbursement related to the severe storm of June 2025, storm that struck northern Minnesota. This is an extraordinary event that happened. The winds reached the equivalent of a Category 3 hurricane that has been described as once-in-a-lifetime storm. The damage was devastating, and the recovery in affected communities will take many years. I'm joined today by several testifiers who can speak in greater detail about the impact of the storm and importance of this legislation.
Have your testifiers begin his testimony after he states his name.
My name is George Prince. I am the mayor of the city of Bemidji, which is also the county seat for Beltrami County. I appreciate this opportunity, chairs, co-chairs, and members, to be able to speak with you today. June 21st was a defining day in the city of Bemidji. We experienced 125-mile-an-hour straight-line winds, which later on, we were told, constituted a derecho. We lost 9 million trees in the affected area. Those trees fell on homes. They fell on businesses. They fell on public infrastructure, power lines, schools, etc. Our people are resilient. They have a great spirit, and we've begun our recovery. However, I'm here today to provide testimony because I'm very concerned about the aftermath of the storm. In fact, I would argue that it is a second storm, and this one's a financial one. And when I look at what's happened to our citizens, I wish I could tell you that insurance has made them whole. It is not. I wish I could tell you that they are able to recover from this financially on their own, but not so much. Some of the challenges we face in our city is that 40% of our property tax, or of our property, is not taxable. We have 20% of our families in poverty, which is double the state average. Additionally, we have neighboring tribal nations that elected to apply for FEMA funding directly to the federal government, which in turn had a negative impact on our ability to hit that actual threshold. For those reasons, we're here and we're seeking an exemption. And as a fellow lawmaker and as a fellow elected official, I understand the value of precedent. I understand the value of being fair and equitable. But sometimes situations come up that are exceptional, that defy the standard, and that cause bodies to relook at policy and reconsider them.
Thank you. Next up, we have Beltrami County Administrator Tom Berry on Zoom. Mr. Berry, do you hear us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes. Mr. Berry, please begin your brief comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 3530. Again, my name is Tom Berry. I'm the County Administrator for Beltrami County, and I'm here on behalf of our residents, our city partners, and a regional community that's still working to recover from one of the most destructive windstorms that we've experienced in decades. The June 21st derecho was unlike anything we've ever experienced, with winds exceeding 120 miles per hour, and multiple tornadoes across the region. The damage was simply catastrophic. In southern Beltrami County, which was the epicenter, the mayor said more than 9 million trees were downed and over 20,000 properties were impacted. The aftermath of the storm was overwhelming, but we are deeply grateful that the state had the foresight to establish a disaster assistance contingency account. As the Director of Public Safety noted, one of the goals of the state's disaster assistance contingency account is to keep affected jurisdictions fully covered when they meet the federal threshold. In reality, the county did meet the threshold for full federal assistance. However, due to the unique government-to-government relationship between the Leech Lake tribe and the federal government, damages within the tribal community were excluded from the county's total as the tribe pursued assistance directly through its sovereign authority. While appropriate and consistent with federal policy, this process had the unintended consequence of reducing the county's official damage assessment to just below the required threshold, despite the fact that the true impact across our shared region clearly exceeded it. As a result, the county is left bearing a disproportionate financial burden for a disaster of regional scale. This is not a true reflection of diminished need, but rather a technical outcome of jurisdictional structure, which is placing a heavy burden on our economically distressed community. We are the second poorest county in the state of Minnesota. Less than one quarter of our land is taxable, and our median household income is significantly below the state average. We simply do not have the capacity to absorb costs of this scale. Please, our community suffered an unprecedented loss in the June 21st windstorm, and now we risk falling short of full recovery due to an unintended loophole. So we respectfully request your support for House File 3530 to correct this disparity to ensure that our community can fully recover from this historic and devastating storm. Thank you very, very much for your time, your favorable consideration, and your service to our great state.
Thank you, Mr. Berry. Beltrami County Emergency Management Director Mueller, do you have any new information, or otherwise we're going to have to move on?
Can you hear me, Mr. Chair? Yeah.
Go ahead.
My sentiments are very similar to that of Administrator Berry. I would just like to reiterate that in my 20 years of experience in public safety, this has been a funding risk challenge that has been known, and it's always been, we'll cross that bridge when we get there, and unfortunately we do find ourselves at that bridge now. With that nuance of the capability and the right of the Leech Lake Nation to pursue that FEMA declaration through their government-to-government relationships. I do believe professionally that that relationship did preclude Beltrami County, as well as the other counties and the White Earth Nation, from being able to seek that federal declaration and receive that full recovery amount. Receiving the 25% match we did not receive will provide critical relief and help our communities overcome the financial burdens from this historic storm. And I do thank you for your attention on this matter. McGwich, and thank you.
Thank you. Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This, just so the committee knows, this impacts, I'm a resident in eastern Beltrami County. I drive 25 miles to Bemidji. That used to be all forest. Now it looks like if you took a couple boxes of toothpicks and threw them on the floor, that's what it looks like. 9 million trees, folks, that's a lot of trees for a county like Beltrami to pick up the tab. So I just wanna ask for a little bit of consideration. These pictures that are included in your package don't do what was done justice. It was horrible. So 9 million trees and on a poor county like Beltrami County, I think is incredible. 25% tax base, so we need a little assistance up there.
Thank you, Representative Bliss. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will attempt to be very brief. I have a lot of sympathy for Beltrami County and Bemidji. I was up there shortly after the storms came through, and it is really horrific. But we say once-in-a-lifetime storm, and that is happening more and more and more frequently. We have FEMA funds that are no longer secure, and insurance isn't going to save us because a lot of places aren't even able to get insured anymore because of these storms and the climate change that is happening that is causing these disasters. We had a recent study done by the MPCA that says that if we do not take appropriate adaptive changes in Minnesota, it can cost... Annual costs of climate change are going to be more than $50 billion by the end of this century. So this is a totally unsustainable situation that we find ourselves in. And this is nothing against your bill, Representative Duran. I'm not saying whether I'm for or against it at all, but I am just taking this moment to note that we absolutely have to do something different in the state of Minnesota. This is an unsustainable situation that we find ourselves in, and I really would hope, what I would love to talk to you about is how we can build back in an adaptive way so that if this happens again, if another storm comes through, that you all are built back in a better situation and one that is more stable and more secure for the future so that we can withstand it next time. So thank you.
Closing arguments or closing statements. I'd just like to note that we do have Allison Farrell from DPMS here. She has submitted a letter. She is available for questions, but if anybody has any questions, refer to the letter. Chair Muller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I did see the letter that Department of Public Safety and Homeland Security wrote. Just want to say that that disaster contingency account was set up for a reason at 7525. Also, we worked really hard with Chair Pawlowski when he was here to make sure that we continued to replenish that account. But I do worry in future years that, especially with what Representative Holland saying, the kinds of storms we're coming through, that even that's not going to be enough. And so just want to make that point. Again, no comment necessarily on the bill, just kind of the broader picture. Thank you.
Well, that makes me want to comment. I grew up in the city of Elk River. I live on a gravel hill, a massive hill of gravel that is used to construct all the roads in the city. And that was, I'm told, I wasn't there, but I was told it was created by an ice age that came down. So ice. Climate's always changed. Representative Duran, brief.
Briefly, I know we don't want to set bad precedents, and I know that there's a little concern whether or not that we should go down this direction. I think we are an outlier here. I think we do need the support. I think with all of the details that are actually provided by us, and we can provide anybody more details in regards to what makes us different than any other county out there, but in just the area as a whole, is a need, but Beltrami County specifically is very poor and it needs a little bit more assistance than most. This is well known, especially throughout the legislation, and I'm about to get gaveled out, so I will be done.
With that, House File 3530 as amended, or 3530 is laid over. The last bill on our agenda is 4031. That is Chair Robbins. Please come to the testifier table with testifiers. I will move House File 4031 for the committee. I see you have an amendment coded A1. Please describe your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I do have an amendment that will get the bill in the shape that I have worked out over 2 years of conversation with Commissioner Schnell and the department and the Office of Legislative Auditor. So we have peace in the valley, and that's what this amendment is about.
Members, any questions about the A1 amendment? All in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. The A1 amendment passes. Discussion, we'll go on to the testifiers for the 4031 as amended. Deputy Commissioner Khan.
Hello again, Chair Novotny and members. For the record, my name is Safia Khan, and I am the Deputy Commissioner of Corrections. I want to first thank Representative Robinson for her thoughtful approach to this bill and her willingness to work with the DOC to ensure the language reflects both sound policy and operational realities. MNCOR is the department's prison industry program, and it plays an important role in preparing incarcerated people for successful reentry. Through work assignments in areas like manufacturing, services, and production, individuals build both technical and soft skills that are essential for success upon release, showing up on time, working as part of a team, communicating effectively, and taking responsibility. At the same time, MNCOR is required by law to operate in a way that is financially self-sufficient. The audit conducted by the Office of the Legislative Auditor focused on how MNCOR calculates the rates it charges private partners and how it accounts for the full cost of its operations. We concurred in whole with the OLA's recommendation and appreciated the opportunity to work with them on this review. In fact, when these concerns were first raised, the department proactively notified the OLA. Since that time, we have already taken steps to improve our practices, including changes to how we calculate costs, set rates, and review contracts to better align with the recommendations of the audit. A majority of the provisions in House File 4031 reflect those improvements, and we are in alignment with what the bill is seeking to do. Codifying these expectations and statutes provide important clarity and help ensure consistency over time, regardless of leadership or operational changes. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify today, and I'm here to answer any questions you have for the department.
Thank you. Next up is Deputy Legislative Auditor Catherine Thiessen from Special Review of the Office of Legislative Auditor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Catherine Thiessen. I am a Deputy Legislative Auditor from the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Last year, we released a report which, among other things, looked into MNCOR's accounting of costs related to two contracts with private businesses. And as Deputy Commissioner explained, we confirmed the observation that had been provided to us that MNCOR's contracts with these two private businesses were less profitable than they could have been had MNCOR used a more inclusive cost accounting approach. We also found that statutes provide no specific requirements concerning how MNCOR should establish contract rates as well as assess the profitability of individual contracts. And while DOC has made changes to its contracting processes related to this concern, we do believe that legislation could be helpful in preventing a similar situation from occurring. And specifically, we recommended that the legislature establish specific requirements for how MNCOR calculates the rates it charges private businesses, as well as to assess the profitability of individual contracts with private businesses.
Members, questions for Chair Robbins or testifiers? Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Robbins, for your hard work on this bill. Happy to be a co-author and really glad to see that everyone has kind of come together to identify the language that can address the issues raised in the OLA report to ensure that the objective of the prison industry enhancement certification program are actually achieved. So thank you so much to everyone.
Closing comments, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you, Representative Feist, for co-authoring the bill and working with me and to our testifiers. This has been an ongoing process where the rates that MNCOR was charging the private businesses were undermining the competitiveness of a constituent of mine, and their jobs were being lost to this program. And I think the OLA stated it well in their summary. They said MNCOR offset its manufacturing costs with cost of confinement deductions in the form of a reduced rate that it was charging the company. And in effect, MNCOR had subsidized this company by absorbing manufacturing costs that should have been paid by the company. So we are correcting that situation, and we obviously want to support the work the inmates do and our learning job skills, but we don't want to do that at the expense of jobs in our district. So thank you, members. I appreciate your considering this bill.
Thank you. And with that, House File 4031, as amended, is laid over. Thank you, Chair Roberts and testifier. There being no further business for the committee today, this meeting is adjourned.